video this week about a lady named Elizabeth Gibson. She was walking down the street in New York City and found a piece of art just like somebody had thrown out, and picked it up, took it to her house, hung it up. Turned out it was from 1970. It was stolen, and it was worth like $1 million. She found it. It was just like an ordinary piece of trash, and she hung it on her wall. She's going to sell it, probably get $1 million for it. This thing you're looking at here is just ordinary stuff that turns out to be extraordinary. These are two Hoover vacuum convertibles. They're the New Shelton Wet Dry 5-gallon double deckers. And it's a piece of art, actually, created by Jeff Koons. And he created these series between 81 and 1981, 1986, and it's called The New. These things recently sold at a Christie's auction in New York for May 13th. Anybody going to guess how much somebody paid for this piece of plastic with two vacuum cleaners in it? $800,000. Yeah, anybody guess more? $2 million higher. Higher. 12. You're almost right on, Jordan. It sold for $11.8 million. Piece of plexiglass with two vacuum. Can you believe that? That great. You know why? It's because apparently, now you may know him, I've never heard of him, but apparently Jeff Koons, if Jeff Koons made it, apparently it's valuable. And so it gets its value not because it's a vacuum cleaner, but because this guy made it. It gets better because this next thing is a painting by my son, Mikey. Let me show it to you here. Go ahead and hit the next slide there. Yeah, there it is. It looks like something I could do, doesn't it? It's certainly not Mikey. I would think that it would be him, but it's not. It was by a guy named William de Kooning, and it was it auctioned off again at Christie's. It was painted in 1977, and November 13th, 2007, this painting sold for, guess how much? 1.2 higher. 7 higher. 20, it's exactly almost right. There you go. $19.9 million. Dollars. Are y'all looking at the same thing I'm looking at? $19.9 million. But again, the value, I don't think the value is so much in the beauty of it, although apparently somebody had to think it was beautiful. But I think the value comes because this guy, William de Kooning, had painted it. It's crazy. Now, have you ever heard of Mark Rothko? Anybody ever heard of Mark Rothko? Again, this looks like something I could do, Mikey could do, Mark Rothko. Actually, way back in like the 70s, one of his works, Rockefeller owned it, and it sold for a lot of money back then. This one just sold this year. He painted it in 1952. It's called Number 15, and it is worth, we're gonna guess, or you just want me to tell you? Because you'll never guess. Somebody guess, throw out a number. 50 million, Renee, you win the painting, because it's sold for 50 million. Now, $50.4 million. But what's the point? What's $400,000 when you're up to $50 million, man? Can you believe that? $50 million. You know why? Not because the paint is really valuable, not because the canvas is really valuable, but it's valuable. They judged it to have that value because a guy named Mark Rothko created it. And that's where the value came from for this thing. And it's amazing how you can see just ordinary things a lot of times that turn out to be extraordinary. You never would have known it if I hadn't told you that that was an extraordinary painting. And there are things like that all over. Have you ever felt just ordinary? Has that ever happened in your life where you just feel regular, just plain? I go surfing, I feel ordinary a lot because there are a lot of guys out there a lot better than me, and I'm just ordinary. I feel ordinary when it comes to leading music, probably a little below ordinary this morning in doing that. You have times in your life where you feel ordinary or less. Have you ever been just maybe in a spiritual desert where everything just seemed like nothing was going to change? It was the same thing over and over, just ordinary stuff, day in, day out. You felt ordinary. In fact, maybe you felt like, I'm just doing the same thing today that I did yesterday, and I'll do the same thing tomorrow that I did the day before that. And it's just over and over again, I feel ordinary, and God, I feel like I'm in a desert, and I feel like you're a million miles away. I go to church, but I don't really hear from you. I try to read my Bible, but I don't really feel like I'm connecting with you. I just feel like I'm in a desert spiritually. Maybe you're in a place like that now, and things are just dry, and it seems like God's far away. And it's not that tragic things are happening. It just seems like nothing's happening. See, that's where Moses was. for 40 years. For 40 years, Acts tells us, he was in this desert. See, Moses, we're back in our study of Moses, the life of Moses, and he was holy not because he was some great guy that glowed, although he ends up glowing later on in the story. It's kind of cool. But he was holy because holy just means separate. It means set apart for God. And he was holy because God chose him and set him apart for a special task. And I believe that in fact, the Bible teaches that everyone that follows Christ is holy, is set apart by God for a special task. And see, here's what happens is Moses has been going, he's raised in Pharaoh's household. He has everything that he could possibly want. They had paintings like that just all over the place, and it was no big deal to them. And they were just common. And he has everything he could want. And then one day, he decides to try to go help his people. And we looked at this last week. And when he goes and tries to help his people, he gets ahead of God, ends up murdering a guy. And now he's on the run. He's a fugitive from justice. He ends up on the backside of nowhere, in the middle of nowhere, in a land called Midian. And when he goes to this land called Midian, he meets seven, I guess, beautiful girls. It doesn't mean seven. He actually marries one of them, but he meets them, helps them. Shepherds are coming, running them off from the well, and he drives the shepherds off, waters the ladies' flocks. The ladies go home, tell their dad. Their dad says, well, who is this guy? Bring him here. Brings him home. He ends up marrying one of those girls, ends up having two kids, and lives here. And if you just read through Exodus, if you just read Exodus 1, Exodus 2, Exodus 3, the dangerous thing is that you could actually think that, okay, it's just a real quick story. But it's not, because at the time that Moses goes to Midian, he's 40 years old. And between the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3, Acts tells us that 40 years have passed. Can you imagine? I mean, 40 years. I mean, how many of us, we won't raise our hands, how many of us are like 40, around 40 years old in here? I mean, think about that. That's the span of your life. This guy who I think apparently had something in him that he knew, I'm supposed to help people. I want to deliver my people. In fact, we saw last week that he turned his back on all that he had at Pharaoh's house and said, okay, I'm going to identify with the Israelites because they were a slave nation, and I want to help deliver them. I want to help make their lives better. At 40 years of age, he does this, and he fails. And so then he goes, and he's in this desert for 40 long years. Every day, no one knows who he is. No one cares who he is. In fact, he ends up just being really more like a hired hand. If you look in Exodus chapter 3, we pick up here, Moses was keeping not only his own flock, but Moses is keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro. Again, not Bodine, but Jethro, the priest of Midian. And he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness. And so here he is taking care of someone else's sheep. And if you remember from the very first study that we had on this, that shepherds in Egypt were looked down on. They were kind of the low life. They were kind of the most menial laborers. They were the guys that brought down your property values. You didn't want shepherds hanging around. And so here this guy goes from being, you've seen the movie, right? Prince of Egypt. The Prince of Egypt, Ten Commandments, got all the power, to being a lowly shepherd. And at this point, he hasn't seen the movie, right? I mean, Moses, he's never seen the movie. He's got 40 years not knowing how it's going to end up. 40 years wandering in a desert feeding sheep that don't respect him. They don't listen to him. They wander off by themselves. He's taking care of them, and he's in a dry and desperate place. Have you been there? You ever felt like that? You felt like God's forgotten about you? Everyone else has forgotten about you? Well, that's where Moses is. And he goes really far away from wherever Jethro's house is. And he ends up on the west side, or the other versions say the back side of the wilderness, which basically means he's out in the middle of nowhere. And he came to Horeb. Horeb is one name for a mountain called Sinai. So he ends up at this mountain called Sinai, which is also called the mountain of God. Now, what's cool about Horeb and the mountain of God is that you would think it'd be like, there'd be like markers to it saying this way to the mountain of God, and it'd have big neon lights. And you would think that when you show up there, it would be the biggest, most awesome mountain all around. Well, it's not. That the mountain right next to it is taller than Mount Horeb. It's surrounded by mountains that are bigger and more impressive than this mountain, which is also known as Sinai. But this mountain has been set apart by God, just an ordinary mountain. God chooses, in fact, later to reveal himself to Moses. It's where he gives him the Ten Commandments. It's where his glory is seen. God does some amazing things on this mountain, Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai. And it's there at this mountain that the angel of the Lord appears to him. So here Moses says, can you imagine? It's a day like any other day. It's probably Tuesday, I think. I think it's Tuesday because Tuesdays are the most average day ever. There's nothing significant about a Tuesday. It's just a Tuesday. It's not a Wednesday where you're halfway there. It's not a Monday where we're going after. It's not a Friday. It's Tuesday, I think. That's not in the Bible, but it's a normal, average, everyday deal. He's taking care of his sheep. He's looking for something to do. He looks up, we'll see in a minute, sees something that's on fire. But all of a sudden, he meets with God. And when he meets with God, everything changes. Everything changes when you hear from God. So you can go through your life every single day, the same thing today as yesterday, the same thing tomorrow as today. And then all of a sudden, something will happen, just an ordinary day. You can't explain it. God shows up. And you hear from God. And I'm telling you, if you've ever heard from God, and I'm not talking about audibly, about just seeing who he is and realizing that he has something more for your life. When you hear from God, it changes everything. It makes all the difference in the world. Have you ever heard from God? Have you ever met with God? Have you ever understood how great he is, how awesome he is? Have you ever understood that he loves you, that he cares about you, that he has a plan and a purpose for your life? That's what it means to go to the mountain of God. It means that not that we go to a physical place, but it means that we go to the place where God meets with us, where we understand who he is, where he shows us who he is, where he reveals himself to us. Have you ever done that? Have you ever heard from him? Maybe that's what you need to do this morning. Maybe this morning what you need is not so much to hear a sermon. Maybe you just need to focus on how great God is and how much he loves you. I love that song. I want you to go pop it off of iTunes and play that in your car this week. And remember, when things aren't looking good, that God cares about you, that God is there. And that no matter what, that even when you think you're alone and you're afraid, that God's there with you. And even when things look bad, God's in control. He can handle it. It hasn't taken him by surprise. So just remember that this week and get alone with God. And that's really what happens here with Moses. He meets him on this mountain. And when he hears from him, he uses an ordinary mountain that is not taller than the other mountains around it. He sees this mountain and he gets to see who God is. And we look how God gets his attention. It's an ordinary average Tuesday. And here's what happens. Then in verse two, let me find Exodus again here. In verse two, Moses is just wandering along, minding his own sheep. Or actually, he's not even his own sheep. He's minding his father-in-law's sheep. He's watching these guys and he sees this flame in verse 2. The angel of the Lord appears to him in a flame, in a burning bush. Look, so here it is. The angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. Now, he looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. He saw this shrub. The Hebrew word, it's not like a significant bush. It's an insignificant, dried up, thorny little, the word really means shrub. It's just a shrub. So here's the amazing thing to me is God, we expect God to show up with like a big giant golden chair, because that's what all the guys on TV sit on. We think it's going to be something really big and impressive. And he shows up. He shows up in a shrub at a mountain that's not any more significant than the other mountains around it, speaking to a guy who's spent 40 years taking care of livestock on the backside of a desert that everyone's forgotten about, a guy that blew it, a guy that failed, an ordinary guy. And the angel of the Lord appears to him out of this burning shrub. And he looked, behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. So the flame keeps going. Moses has probably seen bushes burn a lot of times. He spent 40 years in the desert. And while he's there, he sees this bush burning, but it wasn't consumed. And so it gets Moses' attention, and he turned aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned, he said. And so here's kind of a cool thing. When God gets his attention, when the Lord saw that he had Moses' attention, that he turned aside to see, that he was listening, God called to him out of the bush. He said, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am, which is just kind of a normal response. What's interesting about this is in Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 24, Moses actually says that our God is a consuming fire, that God is awesome. He is holy. And think about how powerful fire is, and it's consuming. And that's how God chooses to reveal himself to Moses here in this fire, and it gets his attention. And when he has his attention, then he speaks to Moses. See, and it just may be possible that the situation that you're in today, that thing that's happened to you, the burning bush in your life, it may not be as insignificant as a burning bush. It may be a job loss. It may be something that's happened in your life that's physical. It may be a relationship issue. It may be something else going on in your life. Maybe that thing that's happened in your life, God has allowed there just to get your attention. And when God gets your attention, if you'll be still and listen, you can meet with him. You can hear from him. That's where Moses is, and that's what happens to Moses. And what's amazing here is that, to me, is that God takes an ordinary shrub on an ordinary mountain, talking to an ordinary man, and he's going to do some extraordinary stuff. And that's what I want you to get today, is that the ordinary becomes extraordinary when it's used by God. The ordinary becomes extraordinary when it's used by God. That's it. Those are the only blanks you have to fill in. I didn't have a whole lot for you to fill in on your outline. So if you're the kind of person that likes to fill stuff in, that's it right there. The ordinary becomes extraordinary when it's used by God. And that's exactly what happens here. So Moses turns aside, hears from God. He says, here am I. But I think at this point, he doesn't even know who it is yet. I think he thinks it might just be the bush talking to me. I don't know what's going on. There's a bush burning. It's not going out. So let's see what's happening here. So yeah, I'm here. I'm listening. And then he said, that's God said in verse 5, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground. The Hebrew word for holy is kadosh. It's used all over, and it means separated by God for God's purpose, separate from sin. And what's amazing to me about this is that the ground that he's standing on, he calls it holy ground, says take your shoes off, because I think one, he's going to say, listen, I don't want you to worry about walking off and taking care of your sheep. I want you to stay here and stay focused on me. So you're going to step onto sand. You're going to step onto gravel. You're going to step where there may be cactuses. You need to be just, I don't want anything between me and you. I want you focused on me. The ground that you're standing on is holy ground. And what's amazing is this is the first time in the Bible that the word holy is used. The first time. And you know what? It's not referring to a guy in a headdress with a robe. It's not referring to a building with all this nice inlay. It's not referring to some saint. It's referring to dirt. Take off your shoes, Moses, because you're on what was ordinary ground is dirt and rocks. But because I'm here, because I have taken hold of the ordinary, it has become extraordinary, and now it is holy. Not because it's dirt that's better than the dirt 100 miles away from here. It's the same dirt. But it's dirt where I'm going to talk to you. And any place that I talk to you is a holy place. My kitchen table is a holy kitchen table, man, because I'm telling you, I hear from God there. It's a great kitchen table. My dad, I mean, that's it. Wherever you meet with God becomes a holy place. And he says that it's not about the fact that the mountain's any better. It's an ordinary mountain. But when I get a hold of it, it becomes, and when I use it, it becomes extraordinary. You're an ordinary man, but when I get a hold of you, you're going to become extraordinary. It's an ordinary bush, but I can make it burn and not burn up. And that's extraordinary. This is just dirt and gravel, Moses, but you're standing on holy ground because it's just ordinary ground, but I'm using it. And so therefore it becomes holy ground. And then he reveals to him who he is. He said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Now we hear those names. And if you have any background in church, this is like a roll call of big guns, right? These are the guys that had it all together, right? Not so much. Abraham, Isaac, they're just ordinary, average guys. They were deceivers. They were liars. They were tricksters. They started off being idolaters. I mean, it's amazing when you read their life stories how they failed time and time again. They were just average, ordinary people, but God used them. And when he used them, the ordinary became extraordinary. And Moses, so he hears this, understands that, okay, this isn't just the bush talking to me anymore, but this is actually God speaking, and God is holy. So he hid his face because he was afraid to look at God. Now, here's our problem. Big problem we have. If God is holy, and he is, that means he cannot, he won't put up with sin. And the Bible says he's a consuming fire, right? So God's holy and he's awesome. He's powerful. There's no way for us to come into his presence. How do we take care? Because the Bible also says that everybody's a sinner, right? I've sinned. You've sinned. We've all sinned. Sounds like a song we're singing. I don't know. But we've messed up, right? We've all broken God's law. So what do we do? Well, what God takes care of it. He makes it possible for us to talk to him without taking our shoes off, even though that's an okay, it's a sign of respect. But he says here in verse, well, in Colossians 1, it's not on the slide, it's not in your bulletin. Write down Colossians 1, 21 through 24, and I'm just going to read it to you. Paul was writing about this whole problem of God's holiness, and he said, "You who were once alienated and hostile in mind, you were against God doing evil deeds, and he is now reconciled. He has made you right with him in his body of flesh by his death." It's by the death of Christ. Because when Christ died on the cross, he paid for our sin, and then his righteousness, whoever placed their faith in him, God says he takes his righteousness and puts it on your account. So when you stand before God holy and forgiven. He has reconciled us in his body of flesh by his death in order to present you holy and blameless and above reproach before him. So the Bible says that Jesus died so that you could be presented to God as holy and as blameless. It doesn't mean you never sinned. But it means your sin has been paid for, it's been covered, and above reproach before him. In other words, they can't even throw an accusation at you because your sin's been paid for. He says, if indeed you continue in the faith, stable and steadfast, in other words, once this has happened to you, there should be a change in your life, not shifting from the hope of the gospel that you heard, which has been proclaimed in all creation under heaven, and of which I, Paul, became a minister. So he tells them this, that basically God reveals himself as totally holy and we've got a problem, but Jesus comes to take care of that. And that's really where you need to go. That's where you need to go. If you haven't trusted Jesus Christ, you've still got a problem between you and God because there's still a sin issue in your life and you need to turn from that sin, give your heart to Christ and surrender your life to him. That's what it means to be a Christian. And so that holiness needs to be dealt with, or the unholiness in your life needs to be dealt with. And once you trust Christ, you are counted as holy. Now, here's what's cool. This is cool. It's cool as well. Look at Exodus chapter 3, verse 7. Hey, what happens when God gets a hold of the ordinary? It becomes what? It becomes extraordinary, right? Yeah, isn't that cool? Now, how many of you ever felt ordinary? Anybody ever felt ordinary? I felt ordinary. Nobody's ever felt ordinary? You guys have self-esteem issues. If you think, I'm just extraordinary, I'm just the best thing since sliced bread, we got problems there. Because we are. We're ordinary, right? You know, one of my favorite sayings I tell my kids all the time, you are special, just like everybody else. You know, you're special just like everybody else. I mean, don't you think about that? Your kids, I mean, they're special, right? And everybody's kids are special, right? Nobody ever had an ugly baby. Everybody's kids are special. And just like there's a very special one right there. Look at that little thing. So you think that, you know, these things, we think we're special just like everybody else. But the reality is that God doesn't need a unique, super gifted individual to change the world. He just needs an ordinary person that will yield to him. And that'll be it. And see, God intervenes here because he cares. In verse 7, the Lord said, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry." How about that? We timed that just perfect. That's it. You know God's in it, right? That's how you know God's in it. So you see that we have timed it. We have timed it. He says, I've heard their cry. I've seen their problem. I've heard their cry. And because of their taskmasters, I know their sufferings. If you have your Bible open, flip back to Genesis chapter 2. And what's amazing is at the end of the story last week, so basically for 40 years, actually at Israel at this point, it hasn't just been 40 years. It's been nearly 400 years they've been in Egypt. But at the end of chapter 2, the last words there, it said, "During those many days, the king of Egypt died. The people of Israel groaned because of their slavery and cried out for help. Their cry for rescue from slavery came up to God. God heard their groaning. He remembered his covenant with Abraham. He saw the people of Israel, and God knew." So even though they thought God had forgotten them, he hadn't. He was there, and he knew. And that's exactly what he says. He tells Moses, he says, "Hey, listen, I've seen it, I've heard it, I know, and I care, and I'm concerned." And so he gets here, and he says, "I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, to bring them up out of the land and into a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey," because we all see the movie, the place of the Canaanites, big old grapes, and the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, and all the other ites. And I'm going to bring them in there, drive those people out. "And behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me. I have also seen the oppression which the Egyptians oppressed them. I will send you to... Here's where it gets a little bit sticky. Here's where things get tough for Moses, because then everything sounds great. Wow, God, you know, I've been here for 40 years thinking about my people back there. I wanted to help them, but I think it's great that you're going to help them. I'm a little concerned as to why you're telling me all this, but I think that's really good that you're going to do that. And then verse 10 happens, and it messes him up because it says, come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I? Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? See, there's the catch. The catch is it's great for God to help people, and we want God to help people. But the reality is when God chooses to help people, he uses other people, and he doesn't use extraordinary people to do it. He uses people just like you. He uses people just like me. And you see, your friend in school, when you start next week, your friend in school that needs help, God put you in their life because he loves them and he cares about them, and I believe he wants to work through you to help them. That person at your office that gets on your nerves that you think, man, they just really need somebody to come alongside them and teach them some, you know, how to relate to people, or teach them, you know, help them figure this stuff out. Maybe it's just possible that while we're praying for them, God will come up to you and say, you know what, I'm going to send you to them to show them how much I love them. I'm going to send you there to help them. Maybe you've got a little extra cash financially and you meet somebody else that doesn't and that needs help. And you pray for them, God, help them, help them, help them. And maybe God's laying on your heart saying, listen, I'm going to send you to do it. That's what he does with Moses here. And Moses is like, wait a minute, God. Who am I? Who am I that I should, I mean, I'm going to go to Pharaoh, no, and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? God, I'm just ordinary. God, I've blown it. I've failed. I've been here in the desert for 40 years. Here's the amazing thing. God used an ordinary mountain to meet with his man. God uses an ordinary dirt and calls it holy. God takes an ordinary bush and gets his ordinary man's attention. And when he's talking to this ordinary man, he says, I'm going to take you, ordinary man who failed, and you're going to go to the most powerful man in the known world at the time, and you're going to tell him to let my people go. I'm going to use you, Mr. Ordinary, to do something extraordinary, because the ordinary becomes extraordinary when God uses it. And here's the thing, God used an ordinary man, because we know the rest of the story. Moses didn't at the time. God used an ordinary man to deliver a nation, and he will use you, an ordinary man or woman, doing ordinary things every day to change the world. And here's the secret to it all, is verse 12. If you're going to change the world, if you're going to make a difference this week, you have to understand and know this. Verse 12, God said, I will be with you. So there's no way, who am I? I can't do this. Well, you can if God is with you. And this shall be the sign for you that I've sent you. And here's what's really cool. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. He says, Moses, it's kind of funny to me too. The sign, he says, is going to come after it's all done. But you're going to bring all those people back to this very place where I first met with you. And I'm going to meet with you again. I'm going to give you my law. It's kind of a weird thing we'll see later on in the story. They actually come back, get the law, and worship a cow at the same time. It's bizarre, but it's a funny story, but we'll get there eventually. But God brings them out of that slavery into this place. So here's the question. Do you feel ordinary? Do you think maybe God can't use you because you're not a superstar? Have you ever felt like it's ever? Well, God, the ordinary becomes extraordinary when God uses it. And the question is, are you usable? Do you know God? Have you looked to him? Have you trusted him? Do you know him? Are you listening to him? We said it last week, and it's really an interesting scientific fact. Because, you know, a lot of times we look at superstars and we think, yeah, of course God's going to use them. Or, you know, but you look at those paintings we saw at the beginning, and you think, man, there's nothing to that. How in the world did that happen? You know, what's up with that? And we see, God, what's extraordinary about me? And we realized last week that 49% of the people in America are below average. Did you get that last week? Nobody, it didn't work again. It was funny at the Crab Shack, I tell you, it was funny. But the 49% of the people, some of y'all get it later. It'll be like an hour from now, because you're like in the 25%. I'm just kidding. But 49% of the people in America are below average. And if that's the case, what if you're one of those people? Because no, we don't grow up thinking that, do we? Always think I'm special. I'm going to be the one that makes it. I'm going to be a bajillionaire and all this. You know, we're going to change the world, and you are. But here's the thing: what if you don't have to be the superstar to change the world? What if you could just change the world by being who you are, and the little things you do every day? What if just by impacting your kids, you could end up changing the future? And the ordinary stuff. We kept looking for the extraordinary and said, you know what? It's just the ordinary stuff. Because, you know, and if we would quit looking to say, God, I need my validation from what I do and how many people know my name and how big my paycheck is and all this other stuff, and said, God, I'm going to find my validation in whose I am, not so much who everybody thinks I am, but who I belong to. Because, see, that's what made those paintings, was who created them. And you know what makes you extraordinary? It's not your accomplishments. It's not your past. It's not even your failures. What makes you extraordinary is whose you are. It's who you belong to. You guys ever watch Antiques Roadshow? You ever watch Antiques Roadshow? It's cool. You ever watch it? You all have good cable, so you don't have to watch it, I guess. So, except for they're in the storm, so you know we're all using the antenna. But Antiques Roadshow, people bring their stuff in that they got from grandma, and they say, "What's this worth?" And they'll go, "Oh, it's worth $300, or it's worth nothing, or it's worth $1,000, or whatever." And they're all excited, and it's really neat. Well, this is like the coolest thing I've ever seen on Antiques Roadshow, which I haven't really watched it for a whole lot, but I've watched a few things. So I just want you guys to check this out. Check this video out. The coolest thing I've ever seen on Antiques Roadshow.
Weaving here. You've got a little bit of history. It sounds quite interesting. First, tell me what you know about it.
Well, I don't know an awful lot about it, except that it was given by Kit Carson, who I'm sure everybody knows in his history, given to the foster father of my grandmother.
And do you know who made this weaving? Do you know what kind of blanket it is?
Probably a Navajo, but that's about all I know.
So you haven't had anybody look at it?
Nobody's ever looked at it that I'm aware of.
Well, Ted, did you notice when you showed this to me that I kind of stopped breathing a little bit?
Yeah, you did.
You just have to imagine what it looks like.
Weaving here. You've got a little bit of history. It sounds quite interesting. First, tell me what you know about it.
Well, I don't know an awful lot about it, except that it was given by Kit Carson, who I'm sure everybody knows in his history, given to the foster father of my grandmother.
And do you know who made this weaving? Do you know what kind of blanket it is?
It's probably a Navajo, but that's about all I know.
So you haven't had anybody look at it?
Nobody's ever looked at it that I'm aware of.
Well, Ted, did you notice when you showed this to me that I kind of stopped breathing a little bit?
Yeah, you did.
I'm still having a little bit of trouble breathing here, Ted.
It took me by surprise because I didn't think much about it. Probably a chief blanket. But
that's exactly what it is. And it's not just a chief's blanket. It's the first type of chief's blanket made. These were made in about 1840 to 1860, and it's called a Ute first phase.
A Ute
first phase wearing blanket.
A Ute
chief's
first
wearing
phase
blanket.
Wearing blanket.
It was Navajo made. They were made for chiefs. And they were very, very valuable at the time. This is Navajo weaving in its purest form. All of these things that we see later with diamonds and all kinds of different patterns comes much later than this. This is just pure linear design. This is the beginning of Navajo weaving.
Wow.
And not only that, the condition of this is unbelievable. Unbelievable. Wow. We see these. We've got a little bit of damage over there.
We have the damage.
Very interesting thing here. This is almost like silk. It's made from hand-woven wool, but it's so finely done, it's like silk.
Wow.
It would repel water. And this here is dyed with indigo dyes. It was a very valuable dye at the time. And what's really interesting is right here, we have an old repair that was probably done in the 1860s. And it's done with raveled bayeta, which is in itself a very important thing in Navajo weaving. So all involved, it's an extraordinary piece of art. It's extremely rare. It is the most important thing that's come into the roadshow that I've seen. Do you have a sense at all of what you're looking at here in terms of value?
I haven't a clue.
Are you a wealthy man, Ted?
No.
Well, sir, I'm still a little nervous here, I have to tell you. On a really bad day, this textile would be worth $350,000. On a good day, it's about $500,000.
Oh, my God.
You had no idea.
I had no idea. I was just laying on the back of a chair.
Well, sir, you have a national treasure.
Wow.
A national treasure.
Gee.
When you walked in with this, I just about died. Congratulations.
Gee.
Congratulations.
I can't believe this.
Now, the value of this that I'm giving is not using the Kit Carson provenance. Provenance is sometimes very difficult to ascertain. If we could do research on this and we could prove without a reasonable doubt that Kit Carson did actually own this, the value would increase again, maybe 20%.
Wow. Can't believe it. My grandmother, you know, were poor farmers. They didn't... she had her foster father had started some gold mills and you know discovered gold and everything, but there was no wealth in the family at all. Well,
congratulations.
Thank you. Gee, well, I'm amazed. I'm flabbergasted.
Isn't that cool? I mean, here this guy has had it on the back of his chair. It's been hanging out in his house, and it's worth all that. He's just an average guy, ordinary blanket, right? But it's valuable. He doesn't even know it, and it's valuable not because it's special wool, not because it's really pretty. It's valuable because of who created it. It's valuable even though people have walked by that blanket for years and years and years and thought, oh, that's just grandma's blanket. But it's got tremendous value. And you know what? People may walk by you every day of your life at work and in your home and at your school. And they look and they just see an ordinary, average man or woman or boy or girl. And they think, they're just ordinary. But they don't know who made you. And they don't know who's called you. And they don't understand that once God gets a hold of something ordinary, it becomes extraordinary. And what if this week, if instead of just your job being your job, you said, God, today I'm going to this job on mission for you. And I want you to take the ordinary things that I'm doing every day, the ordinary ways that I interact with the people around me, the ordinary ways that I'm teaching these kids, the ordinary things that I'm doing. And will you make them extraordinary? And maybe I won't see a burning bush, but maybe just maybe I'll be able to encourage someone. Maybe just maybe I'll give someone, maybe I'll just be able to help someone in a small way. And the ordinary area will become extraordinary when God uses it. Maybe today you need to say, God, I've never really given you my heart, but today I want to surrender my life to you. Today I realize I'm a sinner. I want to turn from my sin. I want to repent. God, I want to trust you. Please change my heart. Please change my life. I want you to just tell him that, just maybe with your eyes wide open, just as we sing this last song. Maybe this song could be just maybe your prayer to God this morning. Because it's kind of what Moses said when he heard from God, and he heard that God had something big for him. So, you know what? Let's stand up and sing this together.